Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of January 16th, 2015. Starting our show today, I want you to think about a gap, a space, distance, really, between where you are now and your ambitions, or the wealthy and everybody else. Maybe a time in your economic life when simply nothing was happening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, we are peering into those gaps, the spaces between people, groups, the forces that drive our economy, or even the personal distances we have to cross to get back on the path we intended. We like weaving listener stories into the show, so come tell us about the gaps in your life or the economy around you. Visit our website at marketplaceweekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're going to start our show on gaps with a singular concept that affects everyone: global inequality. Right now, the richest 1% of people around the world own almost half of global wealth. That's according to the bank Credit Suisse. And that gap between rich and poor around the world filters down to individual countries, populations, and people. We're going to hear about inequality in one of the fastest growing countries in the world, China, in a few moments. But first, we wanted to talk to one of the top scholars of inequality today. That's Branko Milanović, and he teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He measures inequality around the world, and I asked him to take this broad picture of inequality and explain its consequences to us.
Now, the consequences are trickier because you don't have a world government. If you study U.S. income inequality, implicitly what you find sort of speaks to the U.S. political spectrum, to the U.S. media. But when you don't have these institutions globally, there is no addressee to whom you are actually telling certain things. It's only indirectly, like speaking on shows or giving talks, that you actually make people sort of realize and maybe potentially even act upon these gaps.
So you invented a way of measuring inequality, measuring gaps. What do you measure?
Well, you measure essentially differences in income between all individuals in the world. We have anonymous random surveys that you collect, which collect information about incomes, you know, spending patterns, age, education, and so on. And then you essentially have to put them all together to adjust for price levels, because India obviously has a lower price levels than the U.S. And then you have the world or global income distribution. That's something that you could not do that like 15 or 20 years ago.
There seems to be a very important difference between an income gap and a wealth gap. What's the difference and why is that so important?
Well, Lizzie, that's actually an excellent question because people very often think of the two the same, but you know they are not. Income is actually what you're earning, for example, this month or this year. So even if you're very, very poor, if you're really among poorest people in Africa, you would still have something because you would be basically working. But wealth is very different. Wealth is a result of your accumulation and saving and investment over a life cycle or what you have inherited from the past. So the gaps in wealth are much, much greater than the gaps in income. In other words, for wealth, you have actually billions of people and even like about 30% of people in the United States who have zero net wealth. And you don't have people who have zero income.
All of this brings up the very basic question of why? What are the roots of this?
Well, the roots, of course, are manifold. It's not simple. But if you actually just focus on individual countries, let's say, like you look at the U.S. alone, you have historical roots, as we know, you know, differences in education levels, opportunity to actually exercise your own potential, which existed very strongly between, obviously, African-Americans and the others, white Americans. And then you have gaps, which are gender gaps, which still exist. It's very hard when you actually start behind the others to catch up. And if the system does not sufficiently correct for that unevenness, then really that gets magnified. And I think it's not an easy thing to adjust for.
When we heard from one of the people we talked to in China, she referenced education and other social structures as a way to move ahead or a way to kind of keep you stuck where you are. What are the social factors that play into this?
You know, education certainly has historically, at least the last probably century or two, has been a way for people who actually start with relatively low incomes to make themselves much better off and consequently their own children and grandchildren and so on.
Is there a difference between how much these gaps matter in, say, a developed country versus an emerging country like India or Brazil?
I have a nice story maybe that, you know, you might like.
Yeah.
Is that if you take, for example, European countries and take UK, which is pretty unequal in Europe, and let's suppose UK becomes the 51st US state, it would be a fairly moderately unequal state within the United States. But
wow.
Then you take all the U.S. states, and let's suppose U.S. and Latin America become like one country, as it were, then you would suddenly realize something else, that all U.S. states, each individually and U.S. combined, are more equal than any country in Latin America. So that would be kind of a comparison which you can make.
One of the biggest debates that has gone on in the past few years, and I know you've taken part in this, is does inequality harm growth? Because you look at some place like China or India where there's tremendous inequality and their economies have gone gangbusters.
Well, it's true. You know, there was, of course, historically, there was an argument which has some validity that you need inequality in order to actually have rich people, and rich people are going to save. And as they save, of course, they would invest, create new jobs, and then you have increased employment and the economy grows faster. But there is, of course, the alternative view, and we have seen some evidence and we have also have some empirical results that show if you have an inequality which is beyond a certain point, it might have detrimental effects.
All of this raises the question of what should you do to correct inequality, or should you do anything?
At the level of individual countries, I think one big way to try to redress inequality is education. Now, there are, of course, other things like policies, like we have seen arguments for increased taxation, particularly on very high incomes, then to increase taxation on wealth, and then, for example, to increase minimum wage. So these are all policies that you can do at the level either the state or country. But then when you come to the world, obviously you cannot do that because there is no world government. But there you can actually use other things, which is migration, which I think is an important means towards reduction of global poverty and global inequality.
So you think that we should, we being the larger world, we step in and do something about these gaps?
Well, I think so. I think so that we, being like everybody that we can sort of think of, should be concerned, and we are concerned, with gaps within nations. When it comes to the world, you really have to rely mostly on continued high growth rates in China and India, which are really crucial for the world inequality to go down. And then the other way that, of course, rich countries can help is by making migration easier. You know, I actually have a map of the world with 8 points in the world where the gaps are physically between the two countries that are contiguous are really enormous. And what you find out is that you have fences being built everywhere. You actually have lots of poor people who are left behind. You don't use their skills. It's like having discrimination, for example, of women. You have half of the population in some countries that actually are not used. And likewise, if you have high inequality, you have lots of people who are left out.
Branko Milanović is a professor at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Lizzie. It was really a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We just heard about wealth and income gaps around the world, and we wanted to give you a little snapshot of what that feels like. So we decided to go to China. Well, okay, not go to China, but talk to some people there, because China is both an engine of growth and a place where the gap between the rich and poor is one of the world's biggest. We reached out to Luke Sanford and Rylene Lee, two people living in Chengdu, China, and experiencing very different economies.
So when I first came to China, which was like 3 years ago, my salary was about $1,000 a month, which for people who lived in the city that I lived in, which was a smaller town of about 30,000 people, is like a really good salary. When I moved into a big city, which is Chengdu, that salary is barely enough to pay rent and eat on a daily basis. And so here, I make like pennies compared to the people that I see around me every day.
That feeling of discrepancy is not uncommon, either for foreigners living in China or for Chinese citizens.
I don't have any connections or any kind of rich mom or rich dad. So normally I find a job by myself, and I think I earn very little money.
Rylene Lee says the roots of that wealth gap are deeply entrenched.
Most of the rich people will send their kids to go to America or maybe some other countries to pursue the education. It's kind of more like complicated to find a job with a good payment if you don't have a good education. For myself, because I got an education from abroad, I got my job very easily. Some places in China still now, they don't have a good education system, and lots of like countryside still cannot even go to school. But in the city, people will be care about the life standards of the children and kids in cities. They'll have their personal tutors. So yeah, very, very big gap though.
And that gap between people who are making a lot of money and the majority of people who aren't, it's becoming more visible.
People are definitely noticing more and more this big wealth gap. Just today, walking over here, I saw somebody driving a Bentley, which is something that is just totally unfathomable to like 95% of the population. About one block away from where I am right now, there's like a luxury products mall. And then less than a block away from there, there's an area where you can buy food that's full of migrant workers. The juxtaposition is becoming more and more apparent.
On this week's show, we're talking gaps. The macro ones, of course, in our global economy. But on a smaller, more personal scale, there are gaps in how we think about what we want and what we're willing to do or pay to get it. That's where Elizabeth Dunn comes in. She's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and she studies happiness. So imagine yourself in the moment you've decided you want something, but before you've gotten it. I asked Dunn what's happening in our brains right then.
That period between the desire and the satisfaction is actually a really important time. So simply thinking about getting something activates parts of our brains that cease to care about it once we've got it. And in fact, when we're thinking about getting something, it activates more intense emotional responses than when we think about having had that same thing in the past.
Well, that seems so counterintuitive because you would think it's the getting that is so pleasing.
Well, getting is great too, so there's nothing wrong with getting, but there's sort of a magical aspect of the future, which is that because it hasn't happened yet, we can imagine it however we want it to be, which of course, as anyone who's ever taken a vacation knows, you know, doesn't always work out to be the case in real life.
There is a study that has been fairly well cited that people who plan for vacation are happier than non-vacationers. But then when they asked them when they came back from the vacation, it didn't seem to actually make a really big difference.
Yeah, so there's a fascinating study showing that the biggest boost in happiness that people get from vacations actually occurs before the vacation happens. So that's the real benefit that you're buying when you purchase a vacation.
We are talking about gaps on this show. What is going on in that gap between desire and fulfillment?
Well, it depends on exactly sort of what we know about what's going to happen. And one thing that makes a difference is just knowing a few concrete details about the experience that you're going to have or the purchase that you're going to make. Just knowing those few concrete details can make it easier to sort of bring a vivid image to mind of what that experience or purchase will be like. And that turns out to really enrich our ability to derive pleasure in the present from something that we're going to have in the future.
How does this cross over into money?
Well, I would argue that anticipation is a really wonderful and often free source of pleasure. So we can get more pleasure out of our purchases by delaying them, by, say, purchasing a vacation now but not going on it for several months. So in that intervening period, we're not paying, you know, for every day of anticipation, but we're getting this free pleasure in the interim before our vacation even happens.
But isn't some of this, I mean, couldn't you say, come on, you're not in real life, you're living in a fantasy land?
Well, fantasy land isn't so bad. I mean, the good thing about fantasy land is that nothing goes wrong in fantasy land. And, you know, in real life, we all have vacations that end in disaster. I managed to get attacked by a shark while on a vacation in Hawaii.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, so that vacation was terrible. But at least I got to enjoy the anticipation.
I'm sorry, are you okay?
I still have my legs, so that's great. It all turned out okay in the end, but it did ruin the vacation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to talk about the way we buy stuff now, whether Amazon and online purchasing and the sort of instant gratification economy, if that interrupts that psychological process.
Well, I think we miss out when we get things right away. So it's been so interesting to watch over the past few years as delivery times have gotten shortened and shortened. And I think that might be a little bit unfortunate.
So how do you translate knowing what you know into our increasingly wired and instant gratification economy?
Well, for one thing, I think when we are making really happiness-inducing purchases, so particularly something like a vacation, it's worthwhile to consider trying to pay for it in advance, get that painful bit of payment out of the way right away, and then actually take advantage of the sort of intervening time to sort of indulge in that fantasy land and imagine what the experience is going to be like.
When you think about the future, let's talk about long-term planning and say the gap between now and then. If you're trying to save for your kids' education or your own retirement, how do you harness this stuff to work for you?
I think one thing we can do is to make the future more concrete. So when the future is totally abstract, it can be hard to get excited about it. And it's easiest with something really delightful, like a trip. But even with saving for your children's education, having sort of harnessed that evocative emotion in the present will help you save for the future. There's some research showing that creating a kind of picture of yourself using photo editing software to take your own image and make it of yourself when you're 65 can make you realize, like, oh yeah, there is going to be this real person who's actually me who's going to need this money. That can make it more powerful as a sort of draw and as a need and something that you really want to save for than if it's just sort of this vague concept that someday some future version of yourself will need this.
Elizabeth Dunn is a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and the author of Happy Money. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Float above tracks made from pure air. Technology is pushing from every direction, getting faster with each passing second. Prepare yourself.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So we are talking about gaps on this show. And when we think about technology, it seems to me like there's this sort of gap between the idea of the tech or the product, the thing that's coming, and then, you know, the actual thing that we eventually get.
Yes. In the tech world, there are so many different factors that create gaps, right? And companies go at them actually in many different ways, too. So let's talk for a second about the Apple Watch.
Okay.
Which
a lot of hype.
You, of course, a lot of hype. Rumors of the company working on a smartwatch have been going on for at least 3 years. The company filed a patent, which often hints at a possible future, at least staking a claim to a possible future, right, back in 2011.
Wow.
They filed a patent for a, quote, bistable spring with flexible display, translation into English, a wearable device for the wrist. This was years ago, and it just only got announced last September. And on top of that, people are still waiting for it to actually hit stores sometime early this year.
So thinking about the reasoning behind that, you know, Apple can be very secretive. Then they announce the product. And, you know, if you're willing to wait, you get whatever the next iPhone or whatever it is. So why this lag, this gap with the Apple Watch?
Right. So usually what happens is Apple sort of says, we have a new product and it'll be available in stores tomorrow.
And that's sort of how it works.
And you will all go buy it. You Apple minions, et cetera, et cetera. But in this case, we see Apple actually doing something slightly different. And it's the first really brand new consumer hardware product the company's offered in several years, right? Generally speaking, Apple has a pretty interesting way of obscuring the gap, usually. You don't know about the thing until it's like announced and then immediately on the shelf. But Apple as a company has changed a lot in the past decade, Lizzie. And once it was this company that busted out the iPhone, nobody had really even knew it was coming. And in that one move, the company basically made all other mobile phones obsolete, right, in one fell swoop. Now, the world of big tech is actually a lot more complicated. Apple's under more pressure from investors to do certain things with its money. There's more competition from other tech companies making a lot of similar devices, many of them inspired by Apple's phones, for instance. One could make the argument that the gap in the life of the Apple Watch is actually this kind of combination of wanting to get it really right, but also wanting a kind of cushion, right? In part because wearable devices, which lots of other companies have been putting out for years to mixed success, right? People haven't totally caught on to this.
Yeah.
And Apple, in some ways, might be kind of soft launching this thing to make sure it can actually get airborne and people will actually buy it. A cautionary tale here, Lizzie, Google Glass. Remember Google Glass?
Yes.
What's interesting here is that Google Glass was this idea that Google had. They built the hardware. They kind of put it out there and they said, okay, here's this amazing thing that you can put on your face and it will show you things in this little screen and go have fun and play with it and make stuff for it. And it actually wasn't successful in some ways because Google didn't take the Apple approach, right? They didn't hide the gap there. They just put out the product and said, okay, go play with it. Whereas Apple, for instance, might have made something like this and then totally perfected it, built a bunch of different forms of software for it that would make people really want it and want to use it and make it really easy to use and then release it, right? So that's an example of minimizing the gap between idea and product being actually a really bad way of going about it.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Earlier in the show, you heard Branko Milanovic talk about the structural economic gaps that still persist in the U.S. And one of the most pronounced ones involves the relative wealth of African Americans. To start this story, though, we're going to talk about professional football and something that happened last spring. That's when the Philadelphia Eagles cut one of their best players, DeSean Jackson, after they claimed to have uncovered his ties to violent gangs. Jackson is from the Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles, and the Eagles said he still had connections with gang members in his community. As you can imagine, the sports media went crazy.
What happened to DeSean
Jackson?
Now,
obviously, this is making a statement about what kind of tolerance this organization has for the character within that
Things
locker room.
Are starting to come out. We're starting to learn some more about DeSean Jackson and what has happened with him off the field over these last several years.
I don't even know if anyone wants to even use the word alleged anymore. Ties to gangs. And not to gangs, it's the serious stuff. So, another bad day for the NFL and a very bad day for DeSean Jackson, clearly.
Jackson himself denied the rumors a few months later, talking to Stephen A. Smith of ESPN.
DeSean Jackson is a gang member. Is that true?
No, it's not true. Where I come from and where I was raised, you know, do I know guys? Of course. But as far as me, you know, never not have once, man. I always felt I'm a product of my environment, but at the same time, you know, I'm the guy that wants to go out there and do things the right way.
What Jackson just said there, I'm a product of my environment, that's a really key point in what we're discussing next. You could think of it as the neighborhood economic gap, because statistics show that Black Americans are more likely to live in neighborhoods with poverty than any other group. One of the people who spoke out in Jackson's defense was his fellow NFL player, Richard Sherman. Sherman and Jackson grew up together, and Sherman wrote an essay saying, quote, "We didn't run from where we grew up. We aren't afraid to be associated with the people who came up with us." Here's Richard Sherman from an ESPN documentary visiting his neighborhood.
Used to have bums come in the house and, you know, take some of the leftover food from the night before. Yeah. We had bums that would halfway, like, babysit us.
They,
like,
were basically
I mean, because my mom and dad had to work all day. That was just normal life. I mean, you don't know any other way. It's where you're from, it's what you are, and so you can't pick where you're from.
That notion that you can't pick where you're from is really important when we talk about inequality gaps, mobility, and wealth. Jamel Bowie writes for Slate, and he sees this incident as a perfect example of how we talk about wealth without acknowledging the impact of neighborhoods.
What is key about Richard Sherman's point, or what Richard Sherman says, is that this is not a crazy thing. If you're wondering why wouldn't people just move, even though they have a lot of money.
These are NFL players.
Yeah, they're making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars a year. The smarter among them are using that to build a foundation for the rest of their lives. They still want to live near the people they grew up with. This is an entirely rational decision to make. You're valuing family connections over wealth building.
I'd like you to define the distinction you use between income and wealth.
Income isn't the whole story. A Black American family that's, you know, say making $100,000 a year may be doing well on their face, but let's say they happen to be living at a time of an economic collapse and the value of their home declines. Or even crashes, they may not necessarily have the resources necessary to bounce back from that. And that's where wealth comes into the picture. Black Americans and to a lesser extent Latino Americans have just much less wealth than their white counterparts.
But if you've got, say, parents who are making a decent income and, you know, they've quote unquote made it, they've got a good job, isn't that evidence that you can move up out of poverty?
It is. It is definitely evidence that you can move up out of poverty, provided you don't hit any major obstacles.
What happens when something goes wrong?
If a parent loses a job, if a parent passes away, if there is a divorce, it's not just that that immediate household suddenly loses a lot of income, and if it doesn't have very much wealth, is suddenly put far back behind. But odds are good that their family members don't have very much wealth, that their extended networks don't either.
How did the recession figure into all of this? The biggest thing that most Americans own, where most of their money is their home.
For Black Americans and for recent entrants to the ranks of the middle class, which is disproportionately Black Americans, but certainly includes many other Americans, there was a dramatic hit to their wealth because pretty much all of it was tied into housing, and it was all recently tied into housing. because the ability to build wealth has only been in their families for a short amount of time. I mean, and this is really important to emphasize. For a lot of white Americans whose grandparents or great-grandparents may have fought in the Second World War or involved in the war effort, there is the better part of a century of wealth building from the GI Bill to federal housing loans to everything. They've been able to build up housing equity for a long time. Black Americans weren't able to participate that, not in the 40s, not in the 50s, not in the 60s. And so even for the most successful Black American families, there's really just a couple decades of wealth creation there.
Researchers at Brandeis wrote a report saying that half the collective wealth of African American families was stripped away during the Great Recession. That leaves a gap that I wonder, moving forward, how do you fill that? How is that climbed out of?
That's a really tough question. A recent study came out of Chicago on revitalizing Black neighborhoods. Neighborhoods where Black professionals and middle-class Blacks are moving in, buying homes, renovating homes, but they're not seeing the kind of capital investment from outside that you might see in neighborhoods where you have equivalent white families moving in. Finding a way to deal with that, finding a way to bring more capital and bring more sort of outside income to Black neighborhoods, that I think gets us away towards repairing what the Great Recession damaged.
Jamelle Bouie is a staff writer for Slate who covers politics, policy, and race. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Throughout the recession, a lot of Americans had work histories filled with gaps. Bill Marshall is having one now. It began this July when he was laid off from his job at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Marshall contacted us from his home in Devon, Pennsylvania. He says he's learned a lot from his gap, but he starts with one dreaded question.
What do you do? I have nothing to say to that. It feels, let me go down because, it feels bad and isolating in a lot of ways, and I just don't feel like I'm as much of a part of everything, even if that everything is just complaining about work, getting to and from work, having to wake up early because of work, and getting paid too little for work. What do you do? You hope you can say you're starting your own venture or you're starting your own business. You're not going to say, I'm unemployed and living off my savings. Doesn't really impress people. I go to family gatherings and I don't really enjoy them because I always think everyone's talking about me behind my back. I always used to sneer when higher-ups at work would talk about how much like a family the organization I worked in was. But now that I'm not there anymore, I realize that it's sort of true, but it's kind of like a family in which everyone forgets about you if you move away. You do feel adrift. And in the first few weeks after my job ended, I'd tell people how I'd go a whole day without talking to anyone, and they'd say, wow. Sometimes when I do talk to people at grocery stores, I'd clear my throat before it, and I'll go home and I'll think about how I had a conversation, but then I realize that the only thing I said was, that's okay, I brought my own bag. Sometimes you spend more money when you're unemployed than you do when you're working. You have more time to buy things for your house, and you're sitting in your house or apartment all the time, and you see things that you think of replacing now that you're looking at them all day, like a throw rug or a new shower curtain. And you also forget the connection between your money and the work you did to get it, because you're not thinking about how that bad movie just cost you an hour's worth of work. It just cost you $15 or whatever. Well, now money just has, it has meaning because you need it, of course, but when it comes to actual cash, you just don't think about it. They're just sort of like these coupons you're giving people. And this is the first time I've been eligible for unemployment compensation, so I've been living on that. It's not a lot, but I have a lot of savings and nobody to support. I have managed to save enough money that I'm not yet desperate. The good things? I get plenty of sleep, which I know some people would put that in the bad column, but I do feel rested and healthy. There is
age bias, whether people admit it or not. I don't want to train this guy if he's just going to get old and retire. What do you do? I have nothing to say to that.
Just heard from a listener who's in a gap in his financial life. And we wondered, how about the rest of you? Have you had any spaces like that? A lot of you said you needed money before school, or maybe were unemployed for a while.
For about 2 years, I stayed home.
It was, yeah. It was very tough because I was used to having a certain level of income.
I'd rather be busy than have the gap time, so.
Well, I practiced architecture for over 30 years and my own practice, and it went down in the recession.
I got fired.
Yeah, I've been laid off twice.
How would we get pretty bored if there was a gap?
I read voraciously.
A lot of instant noodles.
I did some small projects, but
canned foods, but I try to stay healthy.
You know, because I just learned to live with less.
I learned a lot.
Overall, it's been a very humbling experience.
I'm joined now by Lisa King and Ellen Rogan, financial experts and authors of Picture Your Prosperity. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you. Hi, this is Ellen.
And hi, this is Lisa.
We were listening to those voices of people who had a gap in their financial lives or didn't, maybe some who wanted one. What do you do to sort of shore yourself up against the unexpected?
One thing that you can do is set up what we call a solutions fund. So instead of an emergency reserve, which has all this like scary connotation to it, if you can set up a pool of money, it can be in a savings account or a money market account, that is there for you when something unexpected comes up. And it could be an unexpected opportunity. It doesn't necessarily have to be an unexpected job loss or something bad. That's one great way to reduce stress level and help you move ahead when something when a gap shows up in your life.
I got to tell you guys, though, you know, a few years ago, I got sick, I lost my job, and it was terrifying. And I think it would have taken me a lot to try to do the things that you're talking about. It sounds really hard.
It is hard. I mean, I think in situations like that, and this is Lisa, it's really tempting to want to resort to a pint of or two or 10 of Ben and Jerry's and, you know,
and wallow.
Exactly. It's by no means easy for any of us. And yet, just like other areas of our life, when things are not going as planned or as we would like, the same things that can help us in other areas can help us with financial resilience. So, for example, taking the time to meditate. Again, I know that that sounds silly, like, gosh, you know, I've lost my job. I don't know how I'm going to get.
And this lady's telling me to meditate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We understand. But if you just try taking the few seconds to just take a breath to modulate your breathing can help you calm down. So it's those basics that we return to even on this topic.
It seems to me like a lot of this is caught up in our sense of identity and who we are. We listen to people sort of talk about how it took them a while and it was scary and they didn't know what to do. Have you found that people's pictures change of maybe what they think they're aiming for and then who they discover they are?
To really figure out what is most important to you is actually to create a prosperity picture for yourself. And this is a visual depiction of what you most want to accomplish out of your life. Literally a visual depiction using pictures. I mean, right in the book, we start with 32 pictures, but you could use anything from a magazine or actual pictures to start to envision what you most want to see happen for yourself. And then they're put in a frame based on how soon you want them and how much money it would take. And having this framework really allows you to start to live what you most want to have happen. And that way, when a gap does come about, you're better able to navigate that.
Are there, you know, tricks to not blowing through that solutions fund or budget, if you're using the other word?
There are. This is Lisa. We think that, again, going to this idea of values-based spending is what's really important. And we heard some of that in the interviews earlier. You know, we actually have a great example in the book of a woman who, when her kids left home, realized that her house was not nearly as important to her as it had been before. And she was working at a job that she frankly didn't like so well, and it was stressing her out. She was running up credit card debt because she was spending on things like elaborate vacations to kind of placate herself because she was unhappy at work. And she realized that as she was looking at her spending, that her house consumed so much of her monthly budget and that she wasn't really getting any joy out of it. So she made an unusual decision that most people wouldn't necessarily think about, that maybe her house wasn't a fixed expense. Maybe she didn't really need this big house. So she made a big decision to downsize, go to a condo that was much more affordable, was able to get a different job because she didn't have the big expense, and really turned her life around. And when you're in a situation like, you know, a gap that you haven't necessarily voluntarily signed up for, you can still apply that same approach.
How do you do that if you're on a very small income?
For me, living in downtown Chicago, my parking costs can be astronomical because I don't allow myself enough time to park on the street or take public transportation. I can drive, and that ends up costing, you know, $60 over the course of a weekend to park my car easily. So looking at even small decisions over time can really add up. The beauty of compound interest.
Lisa King and Ellen Rogan, authors of Picture Your Prosperity, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, we're exploring leaps in our economy and in our lives. We want to know, did you ever collect yourself and go for it? Maybe buy that house, get married, jump into a big new financial commitment. We want to hear the dramatic stories of your leap and how did you land. Tell us about how it all affected your life. You can write us at marketplaceweekend.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We've spent this show talking about gaps, big and small. And most of them, whether they're global or personal, are pretty easy to see or visualize. But this next gap is invisible. And that's because it's being filled right now by bees. Yeah, bees. Without bees, we'd lose more than honey. We'd lose billions of dollars from our economy and a lot of the color on our dinner plates. We spoke with Noah Wilson Rich. He's the founder of the Best Bees Company, an urban beekeeping business. He's trying to change the way most bees live now, which is a little bit like long-haul truckers.
About half or even more of all bees, honeybees in the United States, live on flatbed trucks. This is about 1.5 to 2 million beehives that are just living on our nation's highways or maybe temporary rest stops and planes.
What is this thing look like, right? It's not a little Pooh Bear beehive.
So it's a rectangle, and inside there's one queen per beehive and tens of thousands of worker bees going to visit flowers to pollinate and to collect nectar and pollen for their own food. It smells quite floral, sometimes perfumey. It depends on what's in bloom. What's in bloom in the specific areas. Honey from one area will be quite different from honey of any other area. And within the same area, the honey and the smell of the beehive will change seasonally.
And they have this sort of transient lifestyle, I guess, in modern agriculture. How does that work?
It works as a function of monoculture crops. So thinking about the early blooms that are requiring honeybees to travel to the almonds in California, we typically start there because those blooms happen in late February. So once the almond blooms are done mid-March, the bees have to go. They can't stay. There's no food for them. And that's about 1.5 to 2 million beehives that are forced to hit the road and go elsewhere. Luckily, at that time, there are other monoculture crops that require pollination. So the bees hit the road and they travel to the blueberries or to the cranberries or the apples or the oranges. And it's this never-ending circle because we don't have enough food available for bees when those crop blooms fall off.
So we are thinking about gaps on this show. And one of the ones I'm trying to get my head around is the gap between plants that don't have bees and plants that do. So there's this number where the Agriculture Department says bees add about $15 billion in value to crops they pollinate. Explain that to me.
Pollinators are the pivotal aspect of our U.S. agricultural system because without bees, we don't have our foods. We really don't have the fruits, the vegetables, or even the meats that we rely upon. Without bees, we wouldn't run out of food. It would just be quite brown and carb-rich, so to speak.
So what would my plate look like without bees?
It would look like bread. It would look maybe like some butter, except you can think about what do cattle eat. If you're a meat and potatoes guy like my father is, and he says, well, Noah, I don't really care about fruits and vegetables. I say, okay, Dad, well, what about the steak that you're eating? What do cows eat? Well, they eat hay and alfalfa, and what pollinates that? What produces those seeds? It's bees. So even if you think about the honeybees, that's a huge contributor to what's creating our fruit and vegetable sources. But what about the other bees? What about the lesser-known bee species? Honeybees are just one out of 20,000 total different species of bees.
Wow.
Let me blow your mind, if I may, for just
one point. Blow my mind.
It has to do with the alfalfa leafcutter bee.
Okay.
It's pretty random. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Yeah, it's a very obscure bee. This one bee alone is estimated to contribute between $5 and $7 billion to the U.S. economy alone.
How?
So it does this by visiting alfalfa. What eats alfalfa? Our cattle. The entire industry relies upon this little bee that we don't even pay much attention to.
A few years ago, there was this sort of huge panic about colony collapse disorder, and people were saying it's the apocalypse, the bee apocalypse, really bad headlines. What's the state of things now?
So the state of things now is still quite dire, and honeybees and other bee species are still dying. It's a huge problem. I mean, we've got this huge economic contribution of bees, this $15 billion or so every year contribution to the U.S. economy alone. If you scale that out to a global perspective, it scales up to a $100 billion contribution to the global economy every year. With bees dying, that's threatened, and our whole food chain, aside from the economics, is threatened as well. It seems as though the numbers of honeybee hives, they've kind of come up a little bit. So the high was about 5.9 million or 6 million beehives in 1947, and in 2008 it was around 2 million beehives. It has come up since 2008, but one thing we have to pay more attention to is what geographic areas bees do very well in. Bees in cities tend to produce more honey than they do in the countryside. So just by moving hives to areas that the bees are thriving in seems to be a very easy solution to helping our bees.
A couple years ago, we were talking colony collapse disorder. Now it seems we're talking about these frequent flyer mile bees who are getting around the country. Spin forward a few years for me. What will we be talking about in 3-4 years?
In 3-4 years, we're really going to be noticing the innovative ways that people are living together with bees. I think that's really the future. You have great models like here in Chicago and San Francisco and, of course, in Paris and London and Australia that really promote beekeeping, that add incentives to residents, schools, and to companies to get more pollinators out there. That's the future.
Noah Wilson-Rich is a founder of The Best Bees Company. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Jody Avergan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll take a look at the leaps you've made in your financial life and whether and how you landed. To share the story of your leap, visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and click on Go. You can also talk to us on Facebook, on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We'll see you next week, and thanks for listening. This is APM.